So this morning is Thanksgiving Day, and seventh day of the retreat. Inevitably, on certain days, we have a whole constellation of perceptions, memories, and they affect us. And say for myself, not growing up in America, and then the time that I've spent in America has been completely in a monastery, so I don't really have much of associations. But the actual day, of course, is Thanksgiving, and despite whatever perceptions around we can be also creating new perceptions and developing new associations. Or if the old ones are skillful, wholesome, beneficial, useful, then to be able to nurture those, to look after those, to encourage those. And just the a day devoted to Thanksgiving to me is something very special, to actually have a day that we really consciously cultivate a spirit of thanksgiving and gratitude, to really make gratitude a focal point for both a personal and social perception. That's that's something very special. The Buddha points to gratitude as being one of the major qualities indicative of somebody who is maybe like a cultured being or a civilized being. The word doesn't translate so easily into English. That sense of having a maybe like a maturity within our being. Gratitude is an indication of that maturity. So that any time we have the opportunity to direct our attention and to bring into being those qualities of gratitude and appreciation, those are for our long-term benefit and long-term growth in Dhamma. I think when I look back for myself in my own practice and my own commitment to the training, and start off as a young, idealistic stubborn person, and living with a whole bunch of other similar people there's kind of like inevitable kinds of conflicts and competitions and various sufferings that come from that. And then living under a training with somebody like Ajahn Chah, who is incredibly patient. Over time, you keep pounding your head up against the wall of suffering, and sometimes something happens. you actually start to learn things. And I think it was a really big shift for me because so much of practice in the beginning is about me and my suffering, and that's it's important to recognize that. It's important to have that kind of motivation. I think in my case, there was a real deep sense of gratitude arising both to Ajahn Chah and to the tradition. I had ordained as a monk with a sort of a game plan of being a monk for 3, maybe 4 months tops. That was my long-term goal. and that was, at that point in my life, that seemed like a really long time. When I met Ajahn Chah shortly after I ordained, the teacher who I ordained with, was outside of Bangkok, encouraged me to go and pay respects to Ajahn Chah. The very first thing that he said to me after I arrived and paid respects, I just showed up to visit because I'd heard about these forest monks and forest monasteries. Just looked at me and said, "You want to stay here? Yeah, stay at least 5 years." I wasn't ready for that. various things happened, and I stayed for a few weeks, and then continued with my plan of finding a quiet meditation place and focusing on meditation, and I did that, and my mind did become very peaceful. I had some very important experiences in meditation, but I kept thinking about Ajahn Chah, and it was just, okay, 5 years is 5 years. Just have to go and give yourself to him. When I got to the end of 5 years, I just had this tremendous gratitude that he'd pushed me to go beyond what I I thought I could do what I wanted to do. It was without having extended myself or stretched myself, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. So a tremendous gratitude for him. And then after 5 years, I had one of the things that I had done was when I ordained, because I was, when I ordained, I didn't have any kind of long-term goal. It was just to sort of gain some experience and knowledge of Buddhist practice, and being a monk for a short period of time seemed to be a good way to do that. But I still had student loans, and it wasn't that much really, but they were still there. And a group of people who came to the monastery on a fairly regular, from time to time, once or twice a year. And the person who led the group was a radio announcer for a Dhamma radio station that was sponsored by the Air Force. And anyway, he heard that I still had these loans and I was 5 years as a monk. And he just made an announcement on the his radio station, and that was done. And I just had this tremendous gratitude. And then when I arranged for it to be sent back to my parents, and had it transferred to my parents. Then my parents said, actually, you didn't need to do that. And I hadn't seen them since I'd left Canada. I'd usually write a couple letters a year. This was before the days when you can actually use a mobile phone call. And usually phoned once a year and usually write at least two letters a year. I'm actually very close to my parents and my family, but we're not great communicators. Anyway, they said, actually, you didn't need to do that. It was looking like you weren't coming back, so we just paid it off ourselves. And so it was without saying anything, tremendous gratitude to, like everything was supporting me. And I think that, you know, that sounds really, special or extreme, but I think if we all reflect on our life, the reality is that all of us who are here, gathered here, have a tremendous amount of backlog of good karma that has brought us to a place in our lives where the living in a virtuous way, developing clarity and cultivating wisdom and discernment is important to you. So that to be able to recollect all of the things that have supported that, and whether it's external conditions or internal conditions, and things that we ourselves have done, and To really recollect with gratitude. And sometimes gratitude, we think of it as, being grateful to this person or that person. And, you know, that is true, but it's also really recollecting with gratitude directed towards ourselves. Because it goes both ways, and we can make, you know, at any given time we've always made a whole array of choices, to be grateful for the skillful choices that we've made in our life, and that's supported us to be able to place this aspiration for wisdom and virtue forefront in your life, and I know that's it's something we tend not to pay much attention to, and it's easy to. It's easy to forget. Cultivation of gratitude. When we do turn our attention to gratitude, it has a power to transform the tendency to either worry or fear or critical assessment of ourselves or the world around us, and it's helpful to realize there's a bigger picture than. Because it actually isn't all that difficult to see the flaws in oneself and others. I mean, you don't have to go very far, but recognizing the effect of that, and then relying on something that lifts us out of that. It's sort of like the sun coming out and the clouds breaking up and the sky clearing, that's a maturing. That's a maturing in wisdom. It's a maturing in discernment. This quality of gratitude. And it's not a small thing. So that recognizing that these are tools and qualities we rely on for balance. And this is when we think of our practice, the quality of balance is important. How do we balance things so that, you know, when the mind does tend to becoming clouded or is rejecting, pushing away things, or it's sort of swept up in itself. How do we balance that? And this is where, you know, the path of the Buddhas, when he talks about the middle way, you know, it's a middle way for many, that phrase, the middle way, has many connotations. So that learning how to apply this middle way, learning how to dwell in this middle way. So there's a real balance that we're able to abide in and realize. So that this Ajahn Chah used to use a phrase that he'd say, and it was just sort of, it was the connotation of balance, of things being in our practice, in our way of living, in our perceiving things, getting things sort of just right or just enough. So this sense of balance is really important. And, you know, as we cultivate this path of practice, we have to be attending to that balance and just right quality. And of course, the Buddha actually makes that quite explicit in the formulation of the Eightfold Path. In that, but it sometimes doesn't come across so well in the language that we use. Because when it's sort of, you see it written out, and we've got it in our chanting book, right, the path being right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And we can tie ourselves in knots trying to be right, because we're wouldn't want to be wrong, would we? That'd be awful. But that quality of right is more of a just right quality, just enough. Because the word samma, if you know, it's translated as right, and you have to feel for the people who are translators. Because it's so hard to to find words that you want to get all the different connotations, and it doesn't. There's always a problem in any language. But that word samma, its literal meaning is more like togetherness or connected as one, so that for the path to function, each of those qualities works together. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, all of that, it works together. It's connected as one. Ajahn Jeff makes a point when he talking about it of the word samma. Is its roots are in musical theory, and so that right is more of a, again, that just right quality, or right in tune, right in harmony. It's actually working together, functioning together, resonating with each other. So paying attention to that just right quality. One of the images that Ajahn Chah uses of the path is as in the countryside in northeast Thailand. You'd sometimes trees fall and in the forest, and you make the charcoal right there, and you cut it up into lengths, and you lay it out nice and tight, and so then when you want charcoal, and you stack it all up, and then you take the earth around that, and you cover that a stack of wood with earth, pack it really tight, poke a few holes in it, in just the right places, and then you light a fire outside that makeshift oven, and you have to light the fire in exactly in the right place to learn how to do it properly. Because if it's too far away, then it won't draw into the oven. But if it's too close, it goes in and it burns up the wood, so that you get that sort of the fire placed just right. You get your holes poked in just right, so it draws the heat of that fire in, and it transforms the green wood into charcoal. So you're saying it's the same way with this Eightfold Path, this path of practice that the Buddha gives us. We have to learn how to have that balance, have that just right quality of how we apply the path, how we train in order to, so that this path of virtue, of precepts, of moral training, of mindfulness, of awareness, of the settling practices, clarifying the mind, of the investigations and contemplations and insights can work together, that can be in balance, so that the heart of sort of your ordinary person, greed, hatred, and delusion, can transform into one who is free, as one who is peaceful. So that paying attention to that sense of a balance and just right. As we cultivate this path, there's this attuning oneself to the training, and attuning to having that quality of balance, and recognizing when something is just right, it has a big effect. It isn't that we have to have some astounding kind of effort that we put in, or astounding insights that we have to have, but when just these ordinary reflections, perceptions, ordinary inner qualities, when they're in balance and in tune, they have a big effect. And the Buddha gave an image for that. And he said, in the same way that, like a spike from the rice plant or a barley plant, when they're growing, there's those, you see that on wheat as well, and there's these spikes or hairs that grow up from all the seeds that are growing up. He said, in the same way, when a spike of rice or a spike of barley is rightly directed and pressed upon the skin of the hand or the foot, it can pierce the skin and draw blood. And so it's just, it wouldn't do that. Normally it wouldn't happen. But when it's rightly directed and rightly placed, that can happen. So that in the same way, this, what is our views, our thoughts, our speech, our actions, our livelihood, our efforts, our mindfulnesses, our concentrations, all of these, when they come together and they really are in harmony and just right, they can pierce ignorance, they can pierce delusion, and one can come to true realization. This is possible. You know, that attuning oneself to that quality of balance. And I've mentioned it before, I think and it's always helpful to, as a reminder, that when we're speaking of balance, and we think, okay, what is it that is in harmony with Dhamma, is in accord with Dhamma, wholesome Dhammas increase, unwholesome Dhammas decrease. The mind becomes happier, suffering decreases. Mind becomes brighter, sort of the dullness decreases. These are sort of that fostering of the wholesome, skillful Dhammas, mental states. So paying attention to qualities like gratitude and appreciation. Those are wholesome Dhammas that help to brighten the mind. Turning to loving kindness and compassion. These are wholesome Dhammas that brighten the mind. Recollecting our generosity, recollecting our virtue, recollecting the refuges of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. These are our qualities and opportunities for establishing wholesome Dhammas. And so these are opportunities for balance. And when that balance is just right, it has that power to penetrate our delusions and our obsessions, and they really do fall away. Sometimes perception of what we should be doing as practitioners is kind of, if only I were diligent enough, or if I just made enough effort, then it would, something would happen. And we can tire ourselves out in practice, or frustrate ourselves just because we're continually pushing, and it isn't as if there's no effort to be made, but it's how that balance, that just right quality, which is important. And in practice, we've got these wholesome Dhammas, unwholesome Dhammas. We can be tuning into that moment to moment, recognizing, okay, if I get swept up in some kind of selfish obsession, some kind of irritation, I can see the effect immediately. Directing attention to something more immediate that could be more skillful. And one doesn't have to be I've got to practice for the realization of Nibbana. I mean, whatever that is. So if we place it too far away, It's just too distant. In this moment, I can be attentive to this mental state or this mood that I'm experiencing. In this moment, I can be attentive to the breath coming in, the breath going out. In this moment, I can be attentive to a reflection on impermanence. So then, setting the goals more immediate, or making the practice more immediate. And there's a I heard a Thai monk tell a story illustrating kind of application of effort, and he gave the illustration of in the days when the French were Algeria as a colony, then they of course that's sort of heart of the Sahara Desert, and then in order to cross the Sahara Desert, which is, you know, it's a big undertaking. How do you cross the Sahara Desert? They had oil drums set up every 5 kilometers, so that you could this vast desert, kind of, you know, just so easy to lose one's way. But then, just with 5 kilometers spaced apart, you could go across this incredible desert. And so that, with the curvature of the earth, 5 kilometers was just about right, so that you could see, you get to this one, and you could see to the next one. Say, okay, there's that point. So 5 kilometers. So, and then you just keep hopping with these small points, and you get across the desert. And in a similar way, our practice is like that, where we have these points that we can keep referring to. And they keep us on track. They keep us in the direction that's going to take us to our goal. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. These are our in a similar way of these 5-gallon oil drums painted black in the desert, that you can guide your way across that desert. And keeping that as a reference point, keeping that as a not getting too lost in the goal, in terms of conceptions and projections and proliferations about the goal, or in regrets or proliferations and complications of the past. It's just sort of, no, I can bring up a wholesome mental state. I can bring up this wholesome perception. And as we gain that momentum and gain that starts to work together, it functions together, it's connected as one. And that's where that transformation takes place. That the Buddha gives the image of, and I'm just saying, just as the The river Ganges, it slopes, slants, inclines toward the ocean. You know, so too, this Noble Eightfold Path. It slopes, it slants, it inclines to freedom from suffering and to Nibbana. It's where it takes us. So that if one were wanting to go to the ocean, you just get into the Ganges and it'll take you there. And the same way that with this practice, this getting on board this practice, this path that the Buddha laid down for us. Another image that the Buddha uses is, you know, just as if a log, if it were, you know, thrown in the Ganges, and it so long as it didn't get snagged on the right bank or snagged on the left bank and didn't end up in some sandbank in the middle, it end up in the ocean. That's as natural as it gets, in the same way that, and the Buddha is using that as illustrating the middle way again. So long as one doesn't get caught in the extreme of attachment to sensual indulgence, doesn't get caught in the attachment to on the negative side of annihilation, then, and doesn't get caught in say doubts and wavering, which are the sandbanks, then one will end up in the that's, it'll take one to this freedom of suffering. So that's just reflecting on this path, reflecting on the middle way, reflecting on balance, and getting things in attunement, paying attention to the things that do support a kind of harmony and balance within the heart. Because when we do attend to that, real transformation can take place. So we can sit quietly for a bit.